May it please the Court. It's my privilege this morning to argue this issue of privilege. This is an issue that's been near to my heart for as long as I've been doing this, and I've been doing personal injury law now for 32 years. Missouri has recognized for as long as I've been practicing that there are never appropriately issued unlimited authorizations for production of medical records in a personal injury case. The law has been uniform since Stecker v. Dowd back in 1995, that a plaintiff waives her medical privilege only to the extent of the issues raised in the petition. Every party in this case, the respondent, the realtor, the amicus briefs from both sides, all recognize that it's never appropriate for there to be an unlimited authorization for release of a plaintiff's medical records. So the real question before the Court today is the realtor is in respondent's order an unlimited authorization. And for that, we go to the rules of construction of orders. This Court ruled back in 1952 in Casper v. Lee that unlimited medical authorizations, the legal principle is firmly established that the operative effect of an order lies in the order or decorative portions thereof, rather than in any accompanying recitals, findings, memorandum, or opinions. In this case, we have the order of the respondent, which has five paragraphs of recitals, or findings, or opinion, or memorandum, which discusses a number of things. After which it says, in caps, therefore, it is ordered, adjudged, ordered and adjudged. I would submit, I did in my reply brief, because I did not know this was going to be an issue. I thought it was self-explanatory, that everything that follows the bold caps, therefore, it is ordered and adjudged, constitutes a mandatory or decorative part of this order. In my opinion, there is no question that what follows those words is an unlimited release of the plaintiff's medical records, or in this case, a decedent. Similarly, since Thompson v. Ish, 100 years ago, there's been no question that a medical privilege survives the death of the decedent.
Well, let me ask you this, sure. Then. So if the preamble, the recitation language was in the actual order, would you have any concerns about the order at that point in time?
Absolutely. Although it relays some background and actually incorporates the motion into this order, which I think makes it ambiguous itself because it's not attached thereto. I don't know how an order can incorporate a motion which is not physically attached to it. It then says that it's authorizing the production of, quote, any records regarding any, quote, medically significant injury or illness. I think that's ambiguous to begin with. But then it says, in the very next line, it says, medically significant injury or illness suffered by Mr. Fennewald during said time that is called into issue by the allegations set forth in plaintiff's wrongful death action, which isn't attached either, and therefore can't be interpreted by whoever would get this, including but not limited to, colon, and then a recital. When you say not limited to, the opposite of being limited is being unlimited. And when even the preamble, when the recitals or the memorandum recites that we're going to allow you or order you to produce the medically significant, whatever that means, records of this gentleman pursuant to what he alleged.
Well, do you agree? They're saying that you would only produce things related to the colon cancer, and that they're alleging other things contributed to his health problems and or death, and to how long he might have otherwise had to live, and that's relevant to damages. Is there some middle ground here, but that was not explored or was refused? What is that history?
Judge, there are, I suspect, a million ways that this order could have been worded to track the petition and the allegations made by the plaintiff, which would have been entirely appropriate. We would not be here today. The problem is this order does not do so. Back in the Stecker versus Dowd case back in 1995, this Court laid down three ground rules for medical authorizations. It has to be limited in time, It has to be limited to the allegations of the petition or reasonably related thereto, and it has to be limited to specific providers.
So what's that time? What are you alleging the time frame is? So they're saying is that the allegation is that he should have been advised when he was 40 that he should have had his colonoscopy. Is it fair to go back to the date that he was 40 to check his medical history from then?
And, Your Honor, I wasn't arguing about the time limitation in this case. I think that may be a valid argument. I think it may be a valid time limitation. It, however, is not limited to specific providers, as this Court has said it must be.
So you're saying that it may be different amounts of time for different providers as to the colon, whoever would...
Sure, and as I said earlier, Your Honor, I think there's a million ways that this thing could have been ordered. It could have been specifically directed to providers. It could have been specifically directed to different body parts, to different kinds of diseases, to different issues. But it, in fact, was not. The issue before the Court today is this order, not what it could have been. And the respondent included defendants' interrogatories and requests for production of documents where we appropriately objected on the basis that they were overbroad because similarly they were not limited to the body parts at issue or limited to specific providers. The appropriate response should have been, if the underlying defendant thought that was inappropriate, was to call up a motion to compel and get a more responsive but still limited in some way order from the Court.
So are you saying that it was inappropriate to even try to do a subpoena, that this should have been sought through ordinary discovery?
No, I think that the motion of the defendant in this case to ask the Court to issue an order. There are issues now. This Court has held that HIPAA supersedes Missouri law on these issues of releases, and therefore, since my decedent is dead and there is no personal representative, only the Court can issue an order like this authorizing the release of medical records. All that's a given. But beyond all that, it has to be limited by the factors related by every court since Stecker v. Dowd in 1995, and that is, we got a time limitation here. It's not unlimited as to time. It is unlimited as to the medical conditions at issue. It is unlimited as to providers. The order itself is self-contradictory. The order, first of all, I don't know how to read it. It is addressed to any health care provider, employer, or other entity. That's that worldwide authorization, which is specifically prohibited in Jones v. Seiler. It's then orders that you, and I assume that means any health care provider, employer, or other entity, without limitation, disclose said protected medical records and or medical information in any form, including oral, written, and electronic, dating from August 1 of 87 to the present, two, that says Gibbs, Poole, and Turner, colon, that Gibbs, Poole, and Turner, PC, colon, that you. To whom does that second that you refer? Does it refer to the twice stated Gibbs, Poole, and Turner? Does it refer back to the you that came before that? But then it comes to the end of it, after all the unlimited language about all medical records, including but not limited to everything, the last bullet point says all documents related to amendment of any request. Who gets to amend it? What does an amendment of a request mean? It's in the context of jury instructions, a phrase is used, roving commission. This is just a roving commission. This means anybody who thinks they have any medical records or any condition, medical records of any condition of my decedent can produce it or must produce it, and somebody, anybody, can amend this request somehow to get more if they want. Other things, it demands the production of psychiatric records. Psychiatric records have been specifically excluded from discovery where medically significant, medically diagnosed psychiatric conditions have not been pled. There's a long history of cases saying that where it's just garden variety, pain, suffering, emotional distress, that does not open the door for the defendant to obtain the psychiatric records of the patient. Okay. Same is true with alcohol, same is true with HIV. The chilling effect of orders such as this is that it really prohibits the plaintiff from pursuing claims where they might have stuff in their medical records that they would not like the world at large to know. My example is, let's say you've got a an injury to your little finger, and you bring a claim saying, defendant broke my little finger, and it hurts a lot. Okay? If they're allowed to get unlimited medical authorizations, and let's say that person was sexually abused as a child, had a lifetime of history of psychiatric care to try to get over it, this order would allow that to be gotten into. This order would allow that.
So how do we define the limit on what you waive when you do bring suit and you bring up the cases saying where you don't claim psychological, medically diagnosable condition, that you don't waive psychiatric records? Is it records that are reasonably relevant to the conditions which are pled or the damages which are pled, or what is the standard we apply? Because you never would get documents in discovery that are not reasonably likely to lead to discoverable evidence admissible evidence.
I had a line in my brief that says relevance is irrelevant to this discussion. And that's what I've said to courts for the last 30 years in this case, or 22 years since the decision came down against Judge Dowd. And that is that just like it might be relevant to me and it might be very interesting to my client to see what the defendant's client said to him, it's privileged, and I don't get to see it under any circumstances. This is an issue of privilege. That's why I started my argument this way this morning. It doesn't make any difference if it's relevant if that privilege hasn't been waived. It doesn't make any difference how useful it would be to the defense of the case if that
And if relevance is not the way we determine what you've waived, how do we determine what's waived?
According to all the cases from Stecker v. Dowd and Justice versus O'Malley to all the cases since that I'm aware of, it tracks the petition and the allegations. The cases say that you look at the petition, you look at the discovery, you carefully craft.
You put the matters in controversy. Is that
yes,
the language
exactly.
they use?
It's whatever the plaintiff puts in the controversy. But it is not, it is never everything. I was going to say it's not ever everything. It is never everything. And that's the sole issue here, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Chief Justice Fisher, may it please the court, Mr. McCloskey. About a year ago, I asked Judge Joyce to enter an order authorizing the disclosure of medical records. Judge Joyce was provided with a motion which is contained in Mr. McCloskey's appendix, A13 through A19, that sets out the same law that he does concerning patient-physician privilege, which sets out the same law that he does before this court that concerns when patient-physician privilege is waived, sets out the allegations verbatim from his petition regarding standard of care, causation, and damages, and asks the court to apply the facts to the law for purposes of first determining to what extent has the plaintiff waived their privilege over certain medical records because of the allegations raised in their petition. Judge Joyce initially entered sua sponte an order sustaining the motion. Mr. McCloskey requested a period to respond in writing to the motion and did so. And then Mr. McCloskey and I had a detailed, lengthy argument with Judge Joyce regarding my motion. Ultimately, Judge Joyce sustained the motion and entered the order in which Mr. McCloskey was discussing. In entering that order, Judge Joyce specifically sustained paragraph 21 of the motion, which set forth the specific items in Mr. Fennewald's medical record that was being requested.
What was left out?
Excuse me, Judge.
Is there anything that's been left out?
As far as his medical record?
From the last 30 years, yes.
Oh, I think so, absolutely. Because everything first relates to the allegations raised in the petition. Everything is limited to his colon cancer, his pre-existing history.
It doesn't say that in the order, though.
Pardon me?
It doesn't say that in the motion either.
Yes, paragraph.
It says including, right before that list, it says including but not limited.
Right, Mr. Fennewald's colon cancer, history of lymphoma, and when you look at
so
the
So it's
order,
not limited to those by the language that precedes that.
I suppose that's one way of interpreting the motion. That's not the intent of the motion, Judge Breckenridge. It's to identify those issues, those items that are at issue, and in the motion, or pardon me, and in the order, that language is contained in the order as well.
Now, what does the language but not limited to mean then?
So if somebody requires cancer therapy and there's a side effect from cancer therapy, it could include that information. It's an information in which it attempts to capture and avoid the problem that was encountered based upon the authorization that the plaintiff and Mr. McCloskey signed before, in which it was so limited that no healthcare provider would respond and provide records because it was limited to colon cancer, GI disease.
You know, I hear you both saying you're not asking for as much as you got in the order, and he's not saying he would be limited to that. So why haven't you all just gotten together and agreed upon a protective order that would get you what you need and what you're entitled to, and not, it says, give me any employer, provider, or any entity possessing records of decedent is hereby ordered to produce them. I mean, that's really broad.
And just this, I always, you know, take the stand and position, as do trial judges like Mr. Powell or Judge Powell and Judge Fisher beforehand, that, look, the parties need to resolve these things. I think the writ of prohibition is not the path to resolve it. I think that these issues...
Well, this is the order that was in. Was there
I understand, and I think that Mr. McCloskey could have raised with the trial judge the concern over how he's interpreting the order, because an abuse of discretion is defined, or cannot be, when two reasonable parties interpret a document differently. The position of Matta and Modal emphasize that this cannot be an abuse of discretion by Judge Joyce, because they respectfully take the inopposite position of the other. You know, they disagree with how this is to be read. The easiest way, you know, I read it how I do and how I brief before the court. Mr. McCloskey briefs it his way. The remedy is to, you know, ask Judge Joyce to clarify his concerns.
And the reading, there can be different interpretations of a document, but that doesn't make it ambiguous, that the plain and ordinary language of the document will control.
And I agree with that, and I agree that that's the rule of construction of judicial instruments as well, and I believe that's why it's a mistake for Matta and Mr. McCloskey to only read the end of Judge Joyce's order and ignore the entire order, which expressed...
So you're saying they should have ignored the direction that every possible record he's had for the last 30 years be produced, and instead say, no, we're going to limit it because of the recitals before the order,
and
risk being contempt of court.
With all due respect, I don't think that's fair. There it is ordered in a judge that you disclose said protected records and medical information. That's clearly referencing the preceding paragraphs. To take this order just like you don't take a contract, you know, one sentence, you know, out of reading it in its entirety.
Should we give you guys 30 days to work this out before we take it?
I'm but a trial attorney, Judge. I would never tell the Supreme Court what to do.
Well, how much of this information are we supposed to send to the healthcare providers so they can decide what to give you?
That's a problem that we have in Missouri, Judge Fisher. It's a significant problem.
Well, as a practical matter, though, if you send this order to non-party health provider A, they're going to come in and seek a protective order if they feel that the expectation exceeds what they're lawfully obligated to provide. If they try to or you try to move to compel records, then it seems to me that there's a subsequent opportunity to litigate the breadth of the order, which we seem to have forestalled by the writ process. Am I wrong about that?
No, I mean, healthcare providers are increasingly cognizant over concerns about releasing healthcare information. I represent medical groups across the state. I'm repeatedly contacted about subpoena compliance, HIPAA authorization compliance, what can and can't be released. So there's definitely an increasing magnitude of responsibility on providers of what's appropriate to be released, and they are willing to review information to make sure that it's within that context.
And what is opposing counsel to do in the meantime? They're ordered to find every person that the decedent has seen in the last 30 years and ask them for everything and send out this blanket. Should they not do that and risk the ire of the trial court for failing to comply with an order?
So Judge Stitt, there are two things. First of all, I think Mr. McCloskey's clearly stopped from complaining about the order not being directed to a healthcare provider. He has not provided the name of any healthcare provider. And whether, you know, I choose to compel him to produce those names first or state to or have Judge Joyce ruled on what's related in this lawsuit first, you know, is a question of the order of litigation. But to sit there and complain about the breadth of the order when in the underlying action that was dismissed and then the new action that was filed and pattern discovery was propounded in each and not a single healthcare provider identified.
Did you file a motion to compel?
I have not yet, because I've been waiting for this to complete its course.
Mr. Poole, the Seiler case from this court back in 97
yes.
talked about language that was used, all providers, all physicians. They characterized that as being a worldwide authorization, and that was really broad. How do the facts in our case that you
sure.
have distinguish from the Seiler case?
Because, you know, when you look at paragraph 21 of the motion and when you look at Judge Joyce's order, it specifically describes what is related and what has been waived because of this lawsuit. The Seiler case made no effort, I believe it was the Brown and James authorization, to seek that information or to specify what that included. And I should point out, and Judge Wilson may have been his clerk at the time, I forget, but Judge Robertson entered a very powerful dissent talking about a defendant's right to be able to defend itself. And that's what Judge Joyce, you know, ultimately did. She's got to balance the right of privilege of the decedent against the right of the defendant to be able to defend itself on issues of standard of care. They're saying that back to age 40, through the date of his death, that every healthcare provider who came in contact with him had an obligation, had a duty, had a requirement to recommend or advise colonoscopy or cancer treatment.
I have a question about that. It sounds like you're trying to use specific instances of what prior providers might have done to show the standard of care, which is objective, what a reasonable provider would have done. It can't show standard of care, which is what you argued in the brief.
But Judge Stitt, that can be evidence of objective standards. What an individual's history with various physicians did or didn't do in the state of California, in the state of Missouri, I believe he also resided in the state of Kansas, that can be something that an expert relies upon in order to,
but they don't rely on his particular history. The expert relies upon what is reasonable in the field and what a reasonable doctor would do, not what his particular experience was. That's
under the
very
same
different.
Or under the same or similar circumstances by members of the defendant's profession. And here a specialist has been sued, a generalist has been sued, and it's always going to be relevant, especially in this instance where the plaintiff says it does not matter the type of specialty of physician. They have a duty to do this. They have an obligation to do this, and because of this gentleman's family history since the age 40. And so it's something that a defendant is entitled to investigate in defending against a standard of care argument, whether or not his theory of the standard of care is borne out by the patient's own medical history. But in addition to that, you know, these are all issues related to causation, particularly in a wrongful death case. I mean, a wrongful death case that also alleges a disruption to his ability to earn a living. And then with respect to the psychiatric injuries, you know, Mr. McCloskey does not allege garden variety. He's telling the court now that's what he means. He has two paragraphs devoted to types of emotional distress or pain and suffering from an emotional standpoint that this individual was caused to suffer. And, you know, now that he's representing that it's only garden variety, I would be happy to, you know, modify the nature of that order. But that was not before Judge Joyce when she signed that order. And that was not something that was raised when Mr. McCloskey and the decedent signed the authorization back in 2015.
The cases say garden variety is if you have an event, it's stressful, you're going to have psychological effects from the stress, from seeing an accident, from being fired, from whatever. That's garden variety as opposed to depression, diagnosed anxiety, bipolar, something else that,
sure,
that came from it.
But to, you know, raise a claim for relief to one doesn't require the pleading of the other, particularly if somebody is being sensitive about their medical history and they choose to omit the fact that they believe they've been caused to suffer an injury of bipolar or severe depression. They'll state emotional injury or emotional distress or something to the like, because they don't want that included in a public record. That's understandable, and under fact pleading in Missouri, that's adequate to state a claim for that relief. That doesn't mean, by saying that, that only means you're alleging garden variety. An individual can later, you know, claim something more or less, and now in this briefing, Mr. McCloskey seems to be saying it's only garden variety, but that wasn't something before Judge Joyce at the time she entered her order.
Thank you.
I would just, I have 50 seconds left, Judge Stith and the rest of the court. I would just focus on something that the late Elwood Thomas wrote in Brandt 2, hearkening back to McNutt, which summarized what Judge Lamb had artfully written and quoted back to the Bible in 1908. And specifically that relates to, there needs to be always a concern about allowing a plaintiff to use a privilege as a shield and a dagger, one at the same time. And I believe that that is what's being attempted in this matter by limiting the defendant the right to access information to defend against standard of care causation and also be able to determine whether or not the decedent contributed to cause his own injury at any time as well. Thank you very much.
In response to the very first inquiry of the court, we tried. At the end of every hearing on this case, I asked Mr. Poole, can we agree on some language? Give me the language you want. I'm sure I can agree to it. It's evident from his argument here before the court that what he really wants is exactly what this order says, everything, without limitation. That I pled ever since this court ruled in the Stecker v. Dowd case in 1995, we have very specifically written our pleadings to conform to that order so as to not to open the door. We do not allege, as the judge indicated, depression, any kind of diagnosable psychiatric injury. Following the case law that has been the uniform case law for decades, we plead garden variety pain and suffering.
Would you agree, though, that it's difficult to for the trial judge to surgically draft an order precisely laying out the bounds when we don't know who the medical providers were or what records they may or may not have?
Your Honor, I was in the courtroom when Judge Dowd got the court order for the mandate from this court back in 1995. He asked that exact question of all of us assembled in front of him. And he said, it's the duty of the defendant to properly form interrogatories to identify those people by asking the question, who did you obtain treatment for within reasonable time for the conditions and the areas of the body, which, and then recite the allegations of the petition. Based on that information, they then craft the medical authorizations conforming with the pleadings and the allegations. There's no place in the pleadings and allegations in this case, for example, that reflects what Mr. Poole just said, that we're alleging that it doesn't matter what kind of doctor you are, all doctors are subject to that. That's absent in the pleadings. It's absent in this case. It's these specific providers, okay? The one thing I do want to address in my limited time left is that there's been this trend in the defense bar for the last 3 or 4 years, I've noticed, to request these unlimited authorizations and then back up their request by saying the healthcare industry won't respond to limited authorizations. Well, that's allowing the tail to wag the dog. The law of Missouri is the law of Missouri, and if healthcare providers refuse to abide by it, the duty of the defendant, if he wants those records, is to have them compelled. If they won't produce the records, have them held in contempt. My privilege as a plaintiff isn't controlled by a hospital corporation's refusal to recognize that privilege.
Judge Wilson asked the question that isn't there a mechanism where the healthcare providers can come in and challenge the request as being too broad? What's your response to that as a mechanism to protect your client?
I think absolutely, and they do it all the time, Your Honor. They file a motion for a protective order, and sometimes there's an in-camera review. And that's been discussed in the cases since the beginning of this controversy, back in the 90s.
Is your client protected by having to rely on the healthcare providers to decide not to respond to it without seeking relief?
And, Judge, in one of these cases, and it might be the Dandaran case back in 97, where the court specifically said, if the providers produce more than they're supposed to, then they're in contempt. And if the lawyers look at more than they're supposed to, they have an ethical violation.
But does your client's privilege depend on what somebody else thinks it is, or does it depend on what the cases say it is?
Depends on what this court says and has said in the past, Your Honor. There's one other thing I wanted to address, and that is on the issue of whether this is an unlimited authorization. The law going back to Castle DB says that where there are inconsistencies, it has also been held that there is an inconsistency between the recitals and the natural part of the judgment, and that's expressed in adjudication results in the recital. I go back to what I said earlier. The opposite of limited is unlimited. And when both paragraph, whatever it is, 21 of the defendant's motion and the order from the respondent both say, without limitation, or not limited to, when it recites in both the motion and the order, not limited to, that means unlimited. And I don't think there's any other way of interpreting that plain language.
Thank you, Counselor. It's a well-argued case.